Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, let's do it again. It's time to learn about our world and improve our American English skills at the same time. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, we have a story about risk-taking and new businesses in the United States. Then we're off to Thailand to hear about a very important part of the country's economy, tourism. Let's get started with part one. In 2012, two friends in their 20s made a brave decision. They left their jobs as graphic designers for an American magazine to open their own printing business. Then a third friend decided to join them because the idea seemed just too good to be true. The three young artists are now using traditional printing methods and machinery to create modern designs for their businesses. Mario Ritter tells us about the company.
The business, called Typecase Industries, serves the Washington, D.C. area. The company uses a 360-kilogram Platon letterpress machine to make its creative designs. The letterpress is nearly 100 years old and lacks a motor. That means artist Emily Dwendlin has to use pressure from her foot to add the design to the paper.
We print mostly coasters on it, and you know, when we first started doing orders, it was 100. When you get up to 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 coasters, it's a lot of work.
Emily Dwendlin and Stephanie Hess are co-owners of Typecase Industries. Their company has three letterpress machines. None of these machines are made anymore. The Vander Cook 4, for example, was first manufactured in 1935 and produced for about 30 years. Everything at Typecase Industries is done by hand. Workers mix the colors, feed paper into the machines, add oil to the letterpress, and clean it. But why choose to work with old machines? Why not just print from a computer? Stephanie Hess says she likes the older equipment.
It just offers a very different service than digital does now. And, you know, for me, it really goes back to the tactile quality of being able to, like, you know, feel the paper and feel what you're printing and what you're making. And so it kind of makes you really get outside of your comfort zone because you're working in a different capacity. You know, it's not a computer screen. There's no undo button.
Alessandra Echeverry is also with the company. She says she enjoyed taking the old printing presses and giving them a new purpose.
First, we had to learn how to use the machine, which was a different style than we were taught in school. It gives you a high level of appreciation for craftsmanship and mechanics and stuff that is usually outside of the realm of fine art. It's a new world. And then once you understand how it works, how it prints and what's best, what looks best on it, then you start to, like, design specifically for that.
She says learning how to operate an old machine and repair it if necessary was not the most difficult part of the job.
I would say it's been learning how business works versus how creating art works. We didn't know much about, you know, business practices particularly, so that's been the biggest learning curve.
But Emily Dwendlin says they learned.
It's a total dream come true, being able to own your own business. Set your own schedule. All of the work is personal. We try to keep everything that we do very hands-on, very intimate with our clients.
Typecase Industries serves both businesses and individuals. It has produced everything from restaurant menus and colorful posters to business cards. The goal is to create something that makes the clients happy. That is what happened when Ann Hahn and Joshua Garcia went to Typecase Industries. The two were busy making plans to get married and asked the company to design their wedding invitations.
I knew that my style tended more towards like the vintage kind. I love the letterpress designs. I love feeling like the texture on the invitations.
As the three friends learn more about their repurposed machines, they are using the old technology to create new designs and business success. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. For years, Thailand has been a popular country for tourism. Many foreigners went to Thailand to enjoy its culture, natural beauty, and warm weather. But reports about martial law and attacks on foreigners have harmed its image as an inviting tourist destination. This year, the Thai travel industry is seeking to appeal to more upscale visitors and tour groups from China's mainland. The aim is to increase spending at hotels, restaurants, and other businesses across the country. Jonathan Evans reports.
About 1 in 10 Thais holds a job related to tourism. The tourism industry suffered last year because of political tensions. Protests in the capital, Bangkok, ended with Thailand's armed forces taking control of the government. Some foreigners are concerned about going to Thailand. The military continues to rule the country. Foreign media have published reports about tourists being victims of serious crimes on resort islands. Some Thai police were said to have demanded money from foreigners in Bangkok. And reports say taxi drivers made foreigners pay too much for rides around the city. Sukanya Janshu is head of marketing and public relations for the Thai Hotels Association. She is also general manager of the Dusit Thani, a 5-star hotel in Bangkok. She is hopeful about the tourism industry. She says the industry has always been able to recover quickly from natural disasters, political troubles, or economic problems. Thailand is known as the Land of Smiles, and the country hopes to put a happy face on the tourism industry this year. Thailand hopes to welcome 28 million visitors in 2015. That is the same number as its goal last year. In 2014, the number of actual visitors was 26 million. 15 years ago, Thailand struggled to have more than 10 million visitors in a single year. The total rose above 15 million for the first time in 2010. 2 years later, the country had over 20 million visitors. Bariton Sirisatayawang is with the Kasakon Research Center. She says Thailand will try to attract, in her words, more quality tourists in 2015. She says cities like Phuket and Chiang Mai have modern hotels and other services for those willing to spend more money. The largest number of visitors comes from China. The Chinese are considered the best overall daily spenders while in Thailand. Thailand expects more than 90,000 Chinese visitors during the Lunar New Year period. Many of them are receiving etiquette guides. The guides explain how to act in museums and religious centers. They also urge visitors to obey traffic rules and warn against using public property as toilets. Thailand is also popular with visitors from Malaysia, Japan, Russia, and South Korea. But there has been a decrease in Russian tourists since the loss in value of the Russian ruble. Experts say a weakening euro against Thailand's baht is to blame for a decrease in visitors from European countries. The Association of Thai Travel Agents is hoping to increase the number of visitors from Indonesia and China to compensate for the loss of European visitors. The group reports the total number of international tourists in January was up more than 18% compared to January of 2014. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. A woman named Frances Jensen is a neuroscientist. She has been studying the human brain for almost all of her career. But even she was not ready for the job of raising two teenage boys. What made this task so difficult? Trying to find out why intelligent and responsible young people still did stupid things. So Dr. Jensen did what any neuroscientist would do. She studied years of research on the human brain. What she found might clear up some myths or misinformation about teenagers. Myth number one. A teen's body and brain grow at the same pace. When children reach puberty, their bodies change. Teenagers start to look like adults. You might think that their brains are also becoming more like adult brains. Not true, says Dr. Jensen.
The brain is the last organ in the body to mature, and it takes into the mid-20s for it to complete.
Dr. Jensen says if one compares the brain to a puzzle, the teenage brain has many puzzle pieces still not in place. She says the teen brain has a different structure and chemistry from an adult brain. First, Dr. Jensen explains how the brain works. She says we are able to learn through synapses, areas where brain cells talk to each other. The chemicals responsible for synapses are found in high levels in children. Then they drop a little in teenagers and drop even lower in adults. Dr. Jensen explains that this is why children learn things like languages so easily. Myth number two, the teenage brain is resilient. Another myth Dr. Jensen put to test is how teenagers are able to recover from a bad experience, what we call being resilient. At times, she says, the teenage brain is resilient, but in other ways, it is not. Things like stress and drug and alcohol use can give teens long-term problems. She says drugs and alcohol can especially affect a teenager's intelligent quotient, or IQ. Myth number three, teenagers are lazy. When teenagers stay up late at night and wake up late in the morning, parents may think it is because they are lazy. This lack of action, Dr. Jensen explains, is another myth about teenagers. She says a teen's biological clock is set differently than an adult's. A biological clock controls the body's waking and sleeping processes. She explains that the brain releases a hormone to make you sleepy. An adult releases that sleep-causing hormone around 8:30 at night, but a teenager's brain does not release that chemical until about 11 at night. This leads to a later bedtime, even when the teen has to wake up early the next morning. Dr. Jensen says all this new information can help adults do a better job as teachers and parents. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1880, President Rutherford Hayes completed four successful years in the White House. He did not want to serve another term. Hayes was a Republican. His party had great hopes of electing another Republican in the election of 1880. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe report on that election.
Many Republicans wanted to nominate former President Ulysses Grant. Grant had been out of office 4 years. People seemed to have forgotten the political problems that shook his administration. Other Republicans supported the powerful party leader, Senator James Blaine. A third candidate was John Sherman, the Secretary of the Treasury. The Republicans had great difficulty choosing among Grant, Blaine, and Sherman. At their national convention, Republican delegates voted again and again. None of the three men received a majority.
The delegates voted 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. Finally, on the 34th ballot, 17 of the delegates voted for a compromise candidate. He was James Garfield, a Republican leader in Congress. Soon, both Sherman and Blaine asked all of their delegates to vote for Garfield. The compromise candidate won the nomination. James Garfield offered the vice presidential nomination to Chester Arthur of New York. Arthur's honesty had been questioned when President Hayes removed him as collector of taxes for the port of New York. But a powerful party leader there supported him. So delegates gave Arthur the vice presidential nomination to strengthen party unity.
The Democratic Party chose for its presidential candidate a hero of the Civil War, General Winfield Scott Hancock of Pennsylvania. The election campaign of 1880 was not exciting. Democrats charged that Republicans were dishonest. Republicans charged that a Democrat in the White House would make the South too powerful. Many people at that time still hated the South for starting the Civil War. They wanted to keep Southern states weak. 9 million people voted in the election. James Garfield won. He got only 10,000 more popular votes than Winfield Scott Hancock, but he got a majority of votes in the Electoral College. Garfield won 214 electoral votes. Hancock got 155.
The new president was 49 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives for 17 years. He had been a teacher, a college president, and a general in the Union Army during the Civil War. James Garfield became president of the United States on March 4th, 1881. His choices for a cabinet immediately reopened the conflicts that had appeared during the party convention.
The Republican Party had two powerful leaders. One was Senator Roscoe Conkling. The other was Senator James Blaine. Garfield won Blaine's support by naming him Secretary of State. He lost Conkling's support by refusing to name one of Conkling's supporters Secretary of the Treasury. Garfield denied he had promised anything to Conkling. Then he made Conkling even angrier by appointing one of Conkling's political enemies collector of taxes for the Port of New York. That was the most important federal job in Conkling's home state. Conkling refused to accept the appointment. He began a struggle in the Senate to block it.
Conkling charged that President Garfield had failed to observe the policy of senatorial courtesy. Traditionally, the president does not fill federal jobs in a state until he discusses them with the senators from that state. This long-time policy gave senators firm control over local federal jobs. They were quick to attack any changes in the method. But many senators were angry at Conkling. They did not like the way he gave orders to everyone. They did not like the way he threatened his opponents. They did not want to support him on this issue.
After several weeks, it became clear that the Senate would approve President Garfield's choice for the tax collector's job. Conkling decided to resign in protest. He would ask the New York legislature to show its support by electing him again to the Senate. Before this could happen, something very unexpected took place. It happened in the train station in Washington, D.C., on July 2nd, 1881. A man ran up to President Garfield, pulled out a gun, and fired twice. One bullet cut Garfield's arm. The other went into his back.
The assassin was Charles Guiteau. When he fired the gun, he shouted that he supported Roscoe Conkling's political machine. Charles Guiteau was insane. He believed God had ordered him to kill the president. But the words he shouted caused many people to wonder if others might be involved. After all, the vice president, Chester Arthur, supported Roscoe Conkling, too. If James Garfield died, Chester Arthur would become president. History has provided no evidence that Roscoe Conkling, Chester Arthur, or any other political leader had a part in the shooting. Guiteau is believed to have acted on his own. Yet the situation did cause a great deal of tension while the nation waited to see if Garfield would survive.
The president was carried to the White House. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from his back. He could not find it. Days passed. The president's condition changed from day to day. Doctors pushed their instruments into the wound as they continued to look for the bullet. The wound became infected. Garfield grew worse. Then he grew better. He asked to be taken to the seashore. 2 months later, the doctors warned the cabinet and Vice President Arthur that Garfield was dying. The end finally came on September 19th, 1881. The president's body was taken back to Washington. Memorial services were held there. And then the body was taken to his home state of Ohio for burial.
Not until after Garfield's death did doctors find the bullet that killed him. It lay only a few centimeters from the wound. Tissue had grown around it. The bullet itself would not have killed the president. What killed him was the effort made by doctors to find the bullet. Their instruments had spread infection throughout his body. James Garfield had been president for 6 months. He was the second American president to be assassinated. The first, Abraham Lincoln, had been shot just 16 years before.
The man who shot James Garfield, Charles Guiteau, was tried by a court in Washington. He was found guilty of murder. Like those found guilty of plotting to kill Abraham Lincoln, he was hanged. Vice President Chester Arthur was in New York when he received news of President Garfield's death. He quickly sent for a judge to give him the oath of office as president. Arthur was in his early 50s. He would serve one term as leader of the United States. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.